Your book starts with a foreword from Sir John. He writes, "There has never been a better time to be alive. We should be deeply grateful to have been born in this age of unbelievable prosperity." Was he always such a big optimist? What was he like? And what would he make of the world we're living in today? This was written over 15 years ago, I imagine, at this point.
Yeah, he was a big optimist. And in fact, he's known for the saying maximum pessimism, which is bull markets are born on pessimism, grow on skepticism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. The time of maximum pessimism is the best time to buy. We see it as stepping in at a country, an industry, a company's bleakest moments and saying, no, we believe in you and here's capital to support you. Mm-hmm. That is a wonderful way to allocate capital. It's good for everybody involved.
Welcome to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. How to make it, save it, keep it. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. My guests share their practices, principles, and evergreen wisdom. I'm your host, Bogumil Baranowski, author, TEDx speaker, investor, and a founding partner of Sicard Associates, a boutique investment firm founded in New York City. Join me on this quest to unearth the wisdom of the ages. My guest today is Lauren Templeton. She's the founder and president of Templeton and Phillips Capital Management, LLC, a value investing boutique located in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Ms. Templeton currently serves on the board of directors at Fairfax Financial Holdings, the board of directors at Fairfax India Holdings Corporation, and the board of directors of Canadian Solar. Lauren Templeton is the great niece of Sir John Templeton and serves on the board of trustees of the John Templeton Foundation. She's also a current member of the Templeton World Charities Foundation and a trustee of Templeton Religion Trust. Lauren Templeton is the co-author of Investing the Templeton Way, the market-beating strategies of value investing's legendary bargain hunter. She received a BA in economics from the University of the South. We talk about Lauren's childhood and upbringing and growing up around investing, Sir John Templeton's optimism and the concept of maximum pessimism, Sir John's respect for thrift and the importance of saving, making a positive difference in clients' lives, the benefits of being a student of history, Sir John's worldly views shaped by travel. We cover so many stories from Lauren's life and her memories of Sir John, her great uncle. Stay tuned until the end when we talk about Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting and Lauren's recent email exchange with Warren Buffett. Please help me welcome Lauren Templeton. Hello, dear listener. I have a small favor to ask. If you're enjoying the show, please follow, subscribe, and most of all, share with everyone that would like it too. It's all word-of-mouth marketing. It's all up to your fingertips to make a small contribution and become an important part of the success of the show. Thank you. Hello, Lauren. It's nice to see you again.
Yeah, it's great to see you.
Thank you for joining me today. You know that I read your book more than once. I mentioned it to you that I read it many years ago, and I found myself rereading it recently. And I saw it with fresh eyes, and also my own experience helped me see certain things in a different way. So I really appreciated going through it one more time. And I have a number of questions for you about the essence of the book and about your own experience, about the firm you've built together. So I like to start from the beginning, if you don't mind. I'm always curious about childhood and upbringing and how you think it has influenced your relationship with money and led you to a career in investing.
It's very easy for me to take that question. So I've written about this a lot. My father owned two small businesses in our very small town, Winchester, Tennessee. And he and my mom worked really hard. They worked 6.5 days a week. On Sundays, they did inventory. I grew up in their stores. I would pretend I was the manager of their stores, and I greeted all the customers. I spent the majority of my childhood in their stores. I had a tricycle. I would ride it up and down the aisles. And this was in the 80s, and Uncle John's career, John Templeton's career, was really taking off. He had already actually retired and sold his investment counsel business, and he had moved down to the Bahamas. And there was one fund that the acquiring company did not want because it was domiciled in Canada. It didn't have very many assets in it, and he just took it with him to the Bahamas to retire, and he rented an office and managed that fund above a grocery store in Nassau, Bahamas. And that became that was the Templeton Growth Fund. He partnered with a man named John Galbraith, who was very successful at raising assets. And in the 80s, he appeared on Forbes, the cover of Forbes, and he started appearing on Wall Street Week with Louis Rukeyser very frequently. My parents worked so hard, and they decided that they would save 50% or more of anything they made, get the money away from the businesses, and start studying investments full time. They ultimately sold the businesses and went back to college at the same time that I went to boarding school. And they studied accounting, and they set for the CFA examination. But my childhood was really, my memories are all watching my dad and mom learn about investing. They would be glued to the TV when Uncle John would come on Wall Street Week with Louis Rukeyser. At one point, after my father sold his businesses, he took a job with Dean Witter Reynolds, which was a brokerage firm in Huntsville, Alabama, which was about an hour from our small town. And he said, look, I told him I will take this job for 2 years just for the training. And that's it. So he worked there for 2 years for the training. He was actually there during the 87 market crash. And he said he was the only buy order that was put in that day. To say that they were enthusiastic about investing would be quite the understatement. It is no exaggeration that he put me to bed with stories about the magic of compounding. He talked about it all the time. I was allowed to pick one stock per month at the age of 7 or 8. He would get the stock certificate, mat it and frame it, hang it on the wall of my room. My walls were covered in stock certificates. It taught me to think about being an owner of a business instead of just trading a stock in the market. It really influenced my perspective. And the other thing, you know, the Templetons are notoriously frugal, probably even in an unhealthy sense. But every decision I made as a child was an opportunity to learn about opportunity costs. So like a really good example that I remember very well is wanting a beautiful Christmas tree every year. And my dad would instead load me in his pickup truck. We would go to my aunt's piece of property and go cut one down. And it was always ugly and lopsided and had these growths on it. They were cedar trees, so they were not pretty. And I really wanted a beautiful Christmas tree. So one day he put me in his truck and he said, let's go down to the Christmas tree lot. And we got down there and he said, I'll buy you any tree on the lot. You know, how much is the tree you want? And I told him and he said, well, I'll buy you it, or I'll put this money in the Templeton Growth Fund. Now, it's compounding at almost 15%. Let's do the calculation of how much money you're foregoing if you invested today and you withdrew the money at retirement age, which at the time was 65. So he did this over and over and over again. I was very attracted to investing at a young age and found it mysterious and exciting. And I just knew I wanted to go work in the industry.
Your book starts with a foreword from Sir John. He writes, there has never been a better time to be alive. We should be deeply grateful to have been born in this age of unbelievable prosperity. Was he always such a big optimist? What was he like? And what would he make of the world we're living in today? This was written over 15 years ago, I imagine, at this point.
Yeah, he was a big optimist. And in fact, he's known for the saying maximum pessimism, which is bull markets are born on pessimism, grow on skepticism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. The time of maximum pessimism is the best time to buy. And the time of maximum optimism is the best time to sell. So I think because he's coined that phrase, maximum pessimism, some people are surprised that he's so optimistic. Mm-hmm. But when you really think about what buying at the point of maximum pessimism means, it is very optimistic. Exactly. It's when the markets are bleakest, that is when the opportunities are available. So it's a very optimistic view of the world. And he was an optimistic person. He was very cheerful. He was able to try, or he liked to tinker. He liked to try many different strategies. He did not seem fazed at all by failure. We always make that comment to people. It was kind of shocking because he would try new strategies, and if they didn't work, he would shift pretty quickly away from the strategy when it was evident that he had made a mistake or he found something that wasn't working. And he didn't seem to be fazed by the capital he had lost. He liked to keep trying different methods. I mean, there was always valuation was a huge part of what he did. He was a value investor, but he always said, Lauren, there are 100 measuring sticks of value and you should be constantly reevaluating which measuring stick you're using. What worked best for the last 5 years is not going to be the factor that works best for the next 5 years. But he was an incredibly hospitable, cheerful, optimistic person.
So you already touched on the maximum pessimism, which, and you merged the two ideas, which I really like, because when I read the opening of the book and we talk about optimism, yet he was finding opportunities in the maximum pessimism moments in the market. And you merged the two, how you have to be really optimistic to go in and buy when everybody's so fearful. I like that idea.
Yes. And so often so many people paint capitalists and people who invest in the market as when blood in the streets investing, that's such a terrible methodology and it's a greedy way to view the world. And that is just not how I think he saw it or we see it. We see it as stepping in at someone, a country, an industry, a company's bleakest moments and saying, no, we believe in you and here's capital to support you. Mm-hmm. That is a wonderful way to allocate capital. It's good for everybody involved.
It reminds me of the article that Warren Buffett wrote during the great financial crisis when it looked like it's the end of the world, and he told us why it's not the end of the world and what we should be looking forward to. I'm curious about when he picked up this idea of value investing. And in your book, you mention how he was watching his father buy farms at auction.
Yes.
It might have been his first experience with the concept of buying something at a discount. Can you talk about that, his first exposure to the idea?
He grew up in my hometown, Winchester, Tennessee. It's a really country town. And his father was a lawyer, among other things. He was kind of a jack of all trades, kind of a hit it rich type of guy. But he had a law office on the town square. And I could share pictures of this with you because the office is still there. And we have like an old timey town square in my hometown. And his office faced the courthouse step. So in the Great Depression, as farms would come up for auction, as they often would, he would had a very keen vantage point. He would look out the window across the street. And if the farm, there were no bidders standing on the courthouse stairs, he would go across the street and buy the farm for cents on the dollar. And Uncle John witnessed him doing this over and over again. And Uncle John's father, my great-grandfather, you know, had a collection of farms during this time period. Uncle John would actually go with my grandfather and wire them with electricity in some cases, the farm homes. But Uncle John watched him do this, and he found that that is the best time to buy when there are no other buyers. So I think it highly influenced him and impacted his investment philosophy. And then, of course, what the other thing he's known for is investing globally, which was highly unusual during that time period. And I think that really came from his mother, who had a very global mindset. I mean, she was funding a Christian missionary over in China. And I think she just encouraged him to think very broadly about the world. When he went to Yale University, he remarked how peculiar it was that the families from Yale University only invested in the United States. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, upon graduation from Oxford, because he went from Yale to Oxford University, he was a Rhodes Scholar. Upon graduation from Oxford, he left Oxford with a roommate or friend, and he traveled to, I think, 27 countries. And it really impacted his view of the world. So he always said, invest with the largest universe possible, you know, find the largest universe of stocks. And I think that has allowed him over time, or it allowed him over time, to avoid many of the bubbles and manias. You know, so many of us value investors like to talk about the purchasing decision, right? What does the market look like? When do we go in and buy? How do we run a discounted cash flow model? How do we estimate intrinsic value? But really, one of the most important things about investing is having the right temperament to stay away from the manias. And that's not as discussed as often in the value investing community. And it's very important to your returns. And I think having a global mindset allows you to avoid those manias in the market. Because if you're constantly looking for where there's maximum pessimism and where valuations are low, you end up moving capital around the globe based on valuations, and it helps you avoid some of those tendencies towards mania or following the crowd because your neighbors got some high returns and doing well in the market, and you find yourself jealous and end up following them into the market.
You touched on so many things. I'm thinking of my own experience when people ask me about the first book. And obviously, that was the first book that introduced me to investing. But I remember grocery shopping with my grandma and her perception of value and a little bit of an arbitrage who has cheaper items at the market. And the whole idea of value of money and getting a deal, it really stuck with me. So when I picked up investing books, I thought, oh, this is just like shopping for groceries with grandma.
Well, tell me about that. Where did you grow up, and where? Tell me about your grandmother. Why, you know?
So I grew up in Poland, and I was born in 1980. So the first decade of my life, it was still communist Poland, very different era. So I got to witness a massive change in Poland with the market opening up, products arriving, supermarkets arriving. Just the untapped potential of people was just released, and it was remarkable to see new businesses. The stock market was reopened after half a century. Just a remarkable thing to see, obviously followed with hyperinflation, other things.
Yeah.
But pretty much 200 years of history in a decade of a country adjusting from a frozen state to a free market economy very quickly. My grandma grew up during the Great Depression, so she had memories of, you know, tight budgets and the wartime era and the years after the war. So I think her mindset was that you have to spend your money wisely. And I think it stayed with me. And then you talk about thrift and saving in your own experience, but also in Sir John's experience, how it stayed with him throughout his life. And I'm curious to hear more about it in a second. But I was intrigued by the travel part, because it was so unusual at the time for him to travel around the world. And I think even these days, when I talk to investors who are sitting in New York and investing in Brazilian bonds, and I ask them, have you ever been to Brazil? And they say no. And I find it so hard to understand how you can invest in a foreign market not knowing it on one hand, and then being closed off to the world and investing in just one market because you've never seen anything else. I'm curious about that interest in travel and how he was able to deploy it later on in his career and really go global. I find it really revolutionary at the time, much more accepted these days. But at the time, I think it was very, very unusual, wasn't it?
I think it was very unusual. Not many people did it. I think even today, investors don't realize to really invest in some of these markets, especially emerging markets, how difficult it is on the back end. I think, you know, retail investors or common investors just assume how easy it is to buy shares in different countries and settle trades and things like that. It's not always easy. It's complicated. But Uncle John loved to travel. It's a quality in our family. I feel like we all love to travel. There's so much education when it comes to travel. And of course, his trip after his graduation from Oxford University, Balliol College, you know, he was at the 1937 Olympics and saw the building contingency of Nazi soldiers. And, you know, he knew, or he felt, that the U.S. would be drawn into the war, and came back. And so it really influenced the way he allocated capital, his views on the world. He was an early investor into Japan. That's one of his more famous trades. So he was investing in Japan in the 1950s and 60s, first with his own capital and later with client capital. And what he had noticed in Japan was an accounting anomaly. But, you know, he was willing to, in our family, we call it the doctrine of the extra ounce, which is, you know, a little saying we have, we believe in the doctrine of the extra ounce. It's just the little bit, the marginal amount of work you do more than the next guy that gives you your edge. And it's not as big as a lot of people think. But, you know, he was willing to get the annual reports and figure out the accounting anomaly. And of course, he had traveled to Japan, so he had seen the industriousness of the Japanese people. And he felt that Japan was well positioned. And of course, the stocks were really, really inexpensive. So those investments into early investments into Japan really catapulted the returns of the Templeton Growth Fund. In fact, by the time U.S. investors were really piling into Japan in the 1980s, he had already moved out of Japan and put his money into the U.S. stock market. And this coincided around the same time that I think Business Week came out with the piece called The Death of Equities. Mm-hmm. So, as you know, the 70s were a miserable decade in the United States. It was high inflation, sort of an unbridled enthusiasm for collectibles, and stock indices started the decade about the same place they finished it. So it's really a miserable, tough time to be an investor. And the investing community had really given up on U.S. markets. And that's the same time he shifted his capital into the U.S., coinciding with the death of equities. So
probably the beginning of the biggest bull market we've seen so far, I think.
Well, I don't know. This past one has been pretty big too. My daughter, so today is March 10th. I don't know if you want me to time stamp your podcast. Right. Today is March 10th, 2023. Mm-hmm. My daughter, it's her 14th birthday. She was born on March 10th, 2009. Do you know why that date is significant?
I think it was a market low that day.
Bottom of the market during the great financial crisis. I know. So she was born at the bottom of the market. We were literally in the delivery room on a laptop computer buying stocks. And the nurse came in and she told my husband to turn off the computer. And I think she didn't understand that I wanted him on the computer. Uh-huh. And all I said was, well, did you get the orders filled? Were they filled? And I'm trying to remember what stock we were trading that day. It slips my memory. But of course, we didn't know it was the bottom of the market. We had been buying for 3 or 4 months leading up to that. But we did know that stocks were so cheap, we wanted to buy as many of them as we could. And I am definitely on record saying my daughter is ushering in the next big bull market. And she did.
And she did. Wow. That's remarkable. So I remember that week or that time very well. And there were two things that happened. Not as exciting as a baby being born, but also relevant to our discussion. One, I had breakfast with the CFO of Tiffany in a high rise in New York. And it was just me and one other person that showed up to this meeting because everybody was watching their screens instead of meeting with anybody. And I thought, usually getting an appointment or a breakfast or lunch with the CFO of such a large company, it's very competitive, even in New York, to get to that. And I thought nobody wants to talk to him. So really nobody wanted to know, to hear about the business, what's going on. And the second thing was I went to an idea dinner that week. And around the room, everybody went around the room and they asked for the best idea. You know what they said? But buy treasuries, buy U.S. treasuries. Everybody around that room said, this is the time to buy treasuries. And back to your maximum pessimism idea, I thought, if this is not the bottom.
That's a great story.
I don't know what is, but.
Yeah, that's great. And I'd love to shift back a little bit. You said when I was watching your fabulous TEDx talk, which was wonderful, and I would encourage everybody to watch it. It's called The Great Investor in You. So if you haven't heard it, people should look it up. But we have one thing in common, because one of the first books I ever read was One Up on Wall Street by Peter Lynch.
What a book. It really changed my mind about... So just as a backdrop, I was in grad school. I was getting... Well, grad school was in 2003, 2004, but I was in college during the internet bubble burst. So a lot of my professors, I think, lost their own money.
Okay.
And when...
Where were you in college?
So I started college in Poland, and I was in Brussels, and then my grad school was in Paris.
Okay.
I found the book in an English language bookstore in Brussels, the One Up on Wall Street. So they were telling me the stock market is a casino. They were actually making a case and explaining to me how Amazon will fail in the coming year or two because this business has no future, as the stock collapsed 90-some percent at the time. So I was hearing the stock market is a casino. I was hearing that this is not the place to go. And then I go and I pick up a book, One Up on Wall Street, where Peter Lynch explains that at the end of the day, you're buying small pieces of businesses. And to you and I today, it's such a simple idea. But to me at 21, 22, it was a revolutionary idea that it's not a casino. It can be if you want it to be, but you can actually buy small pieces of businesses just the way you are collecting share certificates and putting them on the wall in your bedroom.
Right.
Kind of making a point that they're not for sale, right?
Yeah.
But that idea completely changed my mind. And then I looked up Warren Buffett and Benjamin Graham, and I started reading everything I could. And then I discovered John Templeton, and I discovered a whole other way of thinking about investing and, you know, thinking globally. We didn't talk about it, but the fact that he left New York at the time when people thought New York is the financial capital of the world.
Sure.
And he moved away and actually admitted that that made him a better investor, which I mentioned in my TED Talk. But let's talk about that. I'm curious how he had the courage to leave New York at the time. Was it the 60s or the 70s when he decided to leave New York?
It was the 1960s. I don't remember what year. I would have to look it up. I feel like it was the late 1960s.
But to imagine that, you know, leaving New York at the time where everybody thought that New York is the place to be, but being a independent thinker, original thinker, he decided to leave and set up shop far away from New York. Can you talk about that? I thought it was such a brave decision, and obviously it paid off.
You know, I'm not sure if he had a grand plan. So his first wife passed away very tragically in an accident in Bermuda. It's really a sad story. So he was running his investment counsel in New York. His investment counsel business. He was married and they had three children, and he could finally afford a vacation. And so he bought his wife a vacation to Bermuda, and the kids still remember it. He hung it on the Christmas tree. Like, I don't know if it was a piece of paper or maybe a plane ticket or something like that, but he hung it on the Christmas tree and he took her to Bermuda. And they were on mopeds and they were going around a curve, and a truck came by and had a piece of lumber sticking off and hit her in the head, and she died on the vacation. So this left him with three really, really young children, and he threw himself into work. And my husband and I often talk about this. I do think that he was disciplined before the accident, and he was probably a workaholic before the accident. But when his wife passed away, I think he really became a workaholic. This is how he dealt with that situation. He just went all in on the investment business. There are many sad stories coming out of that, but he eventually remarried. And she also had, the woman he remarried had two children. So they had a blended family. And they decided at some point that he had enough money to retire, so they would sell the investment business and they would move to someplace tropical. And they did some research. They chose the Lyford Key Club, which is on New Providence Island in the Bahamas. The Lyford Key Club was not a prestigious club at the time. It had just started. And like I said, he sold his business, but the one fund that the acquirer did not want to purchase was the Templeton Growth Fund, because it was domiciled in Canada, had a few million dollars in it. He moved the business down to the Bahamas, managed it out at the little office above the grocery store. Actually, my husband, Scott, has worked out of that office before. He used to work for a hedge fund manager that leased the same space. He always told me my returns, you know, improved when I moved here. Mm-hmm. And I one day said, well, why do you think that is? And he said, I mean, he actually thought about it for, you know, a healthy amount of time. So it's kind of awkward part, you know, pause in the conversation. And he said, you know, I think it's because I received the Wall Street Journal a few days later than everyone else. And that was his answer. So, and you think, okay, well, why would that be? And I think it's because a lot of people are tuned in to financial media, especially now, mm-hmm. Whether that's CNBC or Bloomberg, and they're very reactionary. So you're watching the news, reading the news, and you're reacting to the information you're receiving. If you are reading that information a few days later than everyone else, chances are you're going to react to it less because mm-hmm. it's old information and it just becomes knowledge that you have. So, but there are lots of funny stories about him calling brokers from a payphone in the Bahamas, and he would get cut off from the broker. He would stand there with a bag of quarters and they would say, deposit more money. I mean, that's how he managed the business. I really miss him. He was a very, very interesting person. He had several assistants, but it was a small office, like one, two assistants. I'm sure that fluctuated a bit during his career. And his advice to me one time was, Lauren, you don't have to build a very big firm. My assistant is also, when somebody calls and asks for the shareholder relations person, she transfers the call to my other assistant. Somebody wants somebody in marketing, she transfers the call to the other assistant. So he always managed his office very, very, he was very thrifty and frugal.
Oh, you know what I'm thinking about when you mentioned moving away from New York? So I spent most of my adult life in New York, and I left New York during COVID. We moved to a cabin in the woods in Pennsylvania, and then in Georgia. I'm guessing not far from you. We were in the mountains in Tigre in Georgia.
Wow. And
yeah, we ended up getting married on a mountaintop in Georgia. Very different plan that we initially had. We were supposed to get married on a sailboat in Antigua because we sail. We love the Caribbean. And there were lockdowns. Nobody could travel. So we ended up getting married on a mountaintop with a beautiful view and birds flying above our heads. Only my wife, Megan's parents, could be with us, but we streamed online to everybody, family, friends, the ceremony. So
yeah,
a little connection.
I love that. And you're in the Caribbean now?
Yes, yes. So okay. We spend quite a bit of time in the Dominican Republic. So
okay.
A small overlap with Sir John, not the Bahamas, but another island. We just enjoy the climate and the lifestyle. But the one thing that happened since I left New York, I used to write every week. Now it's every other week. The podcast is taking up some of my time too, which I enjoy. Mm-hmm. But people told me, listen, I noticed that your ideas don't sound as if they were written in a big city. And I thought something has changed about how I write. And I think I slowed down. I'm not in such a rush. And also the way I process information, there's a bit of a delay. I take my time. And I'd like to think that it improves my results as an investor. I'm much calmer. In the city, there's so much stimulation. There are events every day. There are lunches and there's breakfast and dinner with all kinds of people trying to offer you things and different ideas and pitch the same ideas. But also you're interacting with the same group of people all the time. So it's hard to be original when you're hearing the same ideas. When you go to a room in March of 2009 and everybody around the room says, buy treasuries. No matter how disciplined you are emotionally, right?
Yeah.
It gets to you and you realize, what if I'm wrong? What if buying treasuries at the market low is the best thing you can do? But now I know it's not. But all this to say that leaving New York or leaving a big hub of any kind can actually improve somebody's performance. I mean, think of Buffett. He left New York where he had his early years. He moved to Omaha. That's pretty extreme too. I'm sure getting information and things on time in Omaha at the time wasn't easy. And our mutual friend, Guy Spier, ended up moving to Zurich and creating a whole new environment. I think it shapes you as an investor, and I think it helps with the discipline, the temperament that you talked about. And Sir John found his formula by living on an island at the time when he was really remote on that island, wasn't he, right? If he was using a payphone to reach a New York broker.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say remote, but you know, the infrastructure was not the way it is now. Of course, this was in the late 1960s, but I completely agree with you. Yeah. I think it's so hard not to follow the crowd that there is some benefit to physically removing yourself from the crowd, that it's such a challenge for investors that there is a lot to be said for not living in one of the financial hubs. Now, of course, I manage my business from a mountaintop in Tennessee, and I'm biased, so I would say that. My dogs come to work with me every day, and you know, very prone to leave work at lunchtime and go for a walk or run or something like that. But I do think it is beneficial to your mental state, which impacts your investment returns.
The environment that you create is as important as the skill and the experience, I think, to really flourish in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about history. So every investor at some point admits that they are a student of history, and so are we, and so was Sir John. I'm curious about that because it really helped him in certain moments in, you know, shifting his investments around, even the fact that he was in Germany in 1930s on one of his travels, if I remember correctly.
Correct.
And then the wartime came, and obviously the market sold off, but he was very active. I think there's a famous story of him buying $1 stocks, a handful of them. Can you talk about that? How did he have, again, you know, the courage and the optimism to step in such a difficult time?
Well, I mean, that would be a hard question for me to answer. How did he have the courage and optimism? I guess, you know, he believed that that was the best time to buy. Like I said, I don't think he viewed those moments as scary. I think he viewed those moments as great opportunities. And he had studied history. So he had gone back, and we write about this in the book. He had studied the excess profits tax that had occurred before in the United States. He incorporated that into what he was doing. He famously invested, and I believe it was 104 companies on the eve of U.S. entering World War II. Those 104 companies, 37 were in bankruptcy at that time. That's where this excess profits tax and knowing about the history of that tax came into play. He thought that with the U.S. entering the war, that all companies would be pulled out of malaise and would have higher profits because of the war. But the most profitable ones going into the war would be taxed. So they would have this excess profits tax levied on them. And the ones in bankruptcy obviously wouldn't. And so 37 of those original 104 companies were in bankruptcy. He had borrowed $10,000 from a previous employer, which is kind of mind-blowing to me. I mean, can you imagine a young person? I mean, $10,000 was a lot of money during those days. And can you imagine a young person calling your previous employer to say, can I borrow $10,000 to invest in 104 companies trading on U.S. stock exchanges for below a dollar? And by the way, 37 of them are in bankruptcy. Uh-huh. And the employer loaned him the money. So he turned the $10,000 into over $40,000. And I can't remember the exact number. It's in my book. But of the 104 companies, I think three or four didn't work out. But it was a very famous trade. And he calls it his first trade in maximum pessimism. So when the moment was bleakest, right before the U.S. entered the war, that's when he went into the market. But I watched him do that so many times during his career. My fund with him launched in June of 2001.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, you know, brand new and 24 years old. And although I'd bought stocks as a child, you know, I'd also gone on to college and had like a normal college career and graduated from college. And all of a sudden he wants to find a fund for me to manage. And so we launched in June of 2001, and September 11th happened just a few months later. So that was like a huge event for me. And I can remember when the exchanges were closed, receiving a fax from him saying, when the exchanges open, please research for me the safest airlines to buy and buy any that fall more than 50% in one day, have standing orders in the market. And we did do that. So whether he was buying airlines post 9/11 or he was investing in Korea on the heels of the Asian financial crisis, he was always looking for these moments of maximum pessimism to enter the markets. And there's a very famous story of him during the 87 crash, getting up and leaving his desk and going to exercise every day. He walked in the surf in the Bahamas. And when he came back to the office, the analysts were, "What are you doing? Where have you been? Don't you know what's going on the market?" And he said, "Sit down, boys. I have good news and bad. The bad news is we're in a bear market. The good news is it's almost over. Please make sure you have your purchase recommendations on my desk by later today." So
there you go. He was ready.
And, yes. And he was, he said, "This is going to make our returns for years to come." And he was right. And that's how I felt on March 10th, 2009, when we were buying stocks in the delivery room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't know it was the bottom, but I felt sure that the purchases made during that time period would make our returns for years to come. And they did. So I have found the most recent market incredibly challenging because it, I mean, until recently where we've had the retraction in the market, and obviously 2022 was a bad year, but leading up to that, it was a really challenging market. It was hard to invest as a value investor. It was hard to find bargain opportunities. And I think value investors were really challenged not to follow the crowd and not to stretch their discipline just a little bit to buy stocks that they shouldn't buy. That was a hard time to be a value investor.
So as we speak about the peak pessimism, in times of peak optimism, it's a tricky place to be because it's the time when the neighbor is getting richer than you are. And I think that's what people really give in to. There was a moment when I had conversations with some really serious investors. They were telling me that stocks are not exciting enough. You have to be in alternative assets, those illiquid, where you commit capital for the long run. These are leveraged investments and so on. And I thought, if people are saying that stocks are not exciting enough, I think we're close to some sort of a top.
I mean, it's mind-boggling what we saw over that decade-plus time period. I mean, there's so many examples of things just that just blew my mind. In early 2021, I think Scott and I were counting well over 750 companies trading on U.S. stock exchanges with a price-to-sales ratio of over 20 times. I mean, if that didn't sound the bullhorn, ding, 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 we have a problem. I mean, that blows my mind. And then, of course, I mean, there was just a gross misallocation of capital. People were grabbing for, I call it grabbing for marshmallows.
Yes. The marshmallows, they're not even there, but.
I know. Speaking of marshmallows, I'm sure you're aware of that marshmallow test. And your audience may not know, I'm assuming we can mention it, but we met recently at a conference in Switzerland that's organized by Guy Spier called ValueX. And one of the attendees there was one of the children in the experiment.
That's true. I forgot about that.
I did too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I forgot to talk to him about it. So I know I'm going to have to rekindle that conversation and hear about his experience as one of the children in the marshmallow test.
So the test was all about waiting for the next marshmallow and basically testing the patience of the kids and then following up with them years later to see how their lives turned out. And it's really interesting that very early on, we develop certain values or skills, I don't know what to really call them, that we become patient. I'm curious about the whole idea of delayed gratification, which really pays off in investing. And sometimes I ask my guests if they think it's a gene, you're born with it, or you can develop it. And they really pause on that question. I'm curious what you think. Is it something that we're born with? And the second thing, and you'll tell me in a minute, I heard this hypothesis that our money story gets developed by the age of 7. What do you think about money gets really pretty much set in stone by the age of 7. And it's really interesting because it made me think of me by the age of 7, of what I thought and how it shape me in the future. But between those two things, you know, delayed gratification, do you think it's a gene? And do you think everything gets shaped very early on? Even the stories you were sharing, it looks like both for Sir John and you personally, you were pretty set in your beliefs early on. Can you mm-hmm. talk about that?
Gosh, I don't know. You would need to have you need to have an expert on to discuss this. What I personally think, I think there's probably a genetic component to the ability to delay gratification.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is probably a genetic component involved in risk taking, the yes. ability to take calculated risk. So I think genes probably play into all of that. So does how much dopamine you have, how much serotonin you have, if you're, you know, have more testosterone or more estrogen. I think all of that stuff plays into it. There's a podcast that I love, Huberman Lab. Mm-hmm. And I've actually written him recently, and I'm like, so I'm really fascinated in this discussion about estrogen and testosterone and why there's so few women working in financial markets mm-hmm. and what it would be like if you tested the women that work in financial mm-hmm. markets. Like, do we have mm-hmm. more testosterone than other women, or is there a hormonal component to that? Mm-hmm. I think all of that plays into your tendencies as an investor. But I think you can learn to override a lot of these things. You know, behavioral finance is a very interesting study, and they've proven that if you're just aware of your tendencies or biases, as they call them, that your returns improve. So I always encourage people to start with a small amount of money as soon as possible, real right. money. I mean, mm-hmm. it doesn't even have to be a lot. A few hundred dollars, buy a stock. Study that company, even if it's just one company, just study it. In fact, one company would probably be better than studying a ton. Just get to know it really, really well and have some amount of real capital invested there. And I think you become accustomed, right? Your brain has the ability to rewire itself through a process called plasticity. So even though you may be wired a certain way that would either give you an advantage or a disadvantage of an investor, you can change that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the science is definitely there to suggest that you can change these patterns. So it's incumbent upon you as an investor to be very honest with yourself about your personality type as an investor. I always say, you know, I love value investing and I believe in it. I love the discipline of value investing. I need the discipline of value investing. That being said, there are other methodologies that have merit.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to make sure your personality type is really well suited for the methodology that you're going to use when it comes to investing. And not everyone has the temperament to be a value investor. And if you don't, that's okay. You can index and do really well.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's genetic. I think you can also rewire your brain. As far as your relationship with money being set at a young age, I haven't read anything to support that, but I can believe it.
I think there's some truth to it, but I like the idea that we continue to shape and reshape our mindsets. And I'm sure there's truth to it as well. And just being aware of your weaknesses sometimes helps. Like if you know that you have a certain bias, just being aware of it, I think it really helps. And so you don't go places where you can get in trouble.
Uh-huh.
I'm curious about the people's aspect, and let me explain. So we manage family fortunes, and the legacy business are families that have had money for multiple generations. The newer clients are families that aspire to have the money last a lifetime or beyond. And it's very important to us to know the people behind the portfolios. And Sir John talks about, or you mentioned in the book, how it was important for him to see the success of his clients, whether they could afford to send kids to school or they could retire comfortably. He was always thinking about who he is working for, the people behind the portfolios. Can you talk about it? In the investment profession, a lot of people sometimes forget that they're actual human beings with their lives behind the financial products. But it's really important to remember that we're doing it for somebody and it has hopefully a positive impact on their life.
Yeah, I mean, I always say that Uncle John was like the first rock star investor because before Berkshire Hathaway AGMs became what they are today, which are awesome. But Sir John would have his meetings in Toronto at Roy Thomson Hall, and he would attract quite a gathering. And the majority of the meeting were just people from the floor asking questions about life. You know, somebody's having trouble with their child. What advice would Uncle John give to that parent? And they weren't always related to investments. I think that he took that role very, very seriously. At one point, and I may get some aspects of this bit wrong, but at one point he had been told by some brokerage firms in Toronto that people were buying the Templeton Growth Fund using leverage, and that it was a great thing, right? Because people were buying the Templeton Growth Fund. And he got very upset by it and went out to the meeting with shareholders and said, do not use leverage to buy the fund. Mm-hmm. I do not encourage it. Now, you know, it would have been better, not from a business perspective, not to say that, but he didn't do that. He knew that wasn't in investors' best interest to use leverage to buy the fund. And so he told them not to. I think he was brutally honest with people that way. He used leverage himself, and people often ask about that because he would speak publicly and he would say, do not use leverage, do not use leverage. He was very careful and cognizant that what he said, people were going to follow his advice. And just because he could do something, he didn't think it was in the best interest of everyone to do something. I mean, he used leverage, but he was never jeopardizing his well-being. He could afford to lose the amount of money he was risking. But he was very careful with the example he set for other people. He made a huge impact on investors. I still meet people today that say, I could send my kid to college because of, you know, your great uncle. He really impacted my life. I just did a podcast with Chris Davis from Davis Advisors, and you should get him to come on your podcast because he was, wow, he was a really interesting person to talk to. And he has a degree in theology. So I asked him, how did you get from theology to investing? Now, of course, his family has a long history of investing and being in the investment business. So we were talking about that. And he said, you know, he at one point that he was almost ashamed that he worked in the investment business. He didn't think it was a high calling, as he called it. He had remarked that it wasn't a high calling to Tom Gaynor of Markel. Mm-hmm. And Tom said, Chris, stewardship is a biblical profession.
Wow.
And he said, oh, it really changed my view on my role. And when you think about it, stewardship is a biblical profession. Mm-hmm. You are there to be a steward of somebody else's assets. Mm-hmm. That is a critical role. And you have to always remember that you're responsible for somebody's well-being, their ability to send their kids to college, their ability to buy a second home or have a stress-free retirement. It's a serious responsibility. So,
yeah, it's a huge responsibility. I was going to ask you, so we all have influences. We talked about Peter Lynch, Sir John, Warren Buffett. But I'm curious to hear if you're open to share about Lauren and Scott's way. What is your way that you developed that got inspired, obviously, by a lot of people that we both, you know, respect and admire? But what is it? Tell me more.
Well, our investment philosophy, is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
I mean, it's been honed over the years. So it is the Templeton investment philosophy, but we remain very cognizant of that. You know, there are 100 measuring sticks of value, and you should always reevaluate that. We manage a global portfolio, so we're moving capital around the globe as valuations direct us to. We're very much directed by valuations where we place capital. Mm-hmm. And we've spent our career studying John Templeton's investment philosophy. If your listeners don't know, Scott is my husband. We work together, which is a really unusual situation, I think. But we've been doing it for many, many years and enjoy working together. We each have different roles in the company, but we, you know, honed our strategy working with John Templeton over many years. How would we differ? So our portfolio or our commingled fund does have a short book. Mm-hmm. Uncle John did short securities. He famously shorted them in the dot-com mania of the late 90s. This is a great story. So I had just graduated from college and I flew down to the Bahamas to meet with him. It's 1998. And I sat down with him. I remember it. We were by the pool sitting by at a table. And I said, Uncle John, what tech stocks are you buying? And he just looked at me like, what? And he said, well, I'm actually shorting them. And I've come up with a great strategy that I call the IPO lockup strategy. Uh-huh. And, I short a stock 7 days prior to IPO lockup expiration. I cover 10 to 11 days later. And it was a great strategy. It worked very, very well. But Scott and I have changed our shorting strategy. Of course, with IPOs now, companies are savvy to the strategy. So there's not just one IPO lockup expiration date, right? It's spread out and it doesn't have as big of an impact as it used to. Although there's still a lot of validity to that strategy. Scott and I, for our short portfolio, we don't short just on valuation alone. We're looking at for some catalyst there. And I think we differ a bit on our short strategy than Uncle John did. But of course, he was always changing. So who knows what he'd be doing today.
Last question I have for you is about success. I like to ask my guests about their own definition of success. I'm curious if it's a destination. Is it a journey? How do you know you're on track? And how do you think about success? And it can be a professional or personal, but just the idea of success.
You know, I don't really think about it.
Good.
I want to have an adventurous life where I'm continuously learning. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when I think about investing, although I've been doing it for so many years and since I was a young child, it's not the highest ranked activity on my list. Mm-hmm. So first is learning about the world, learning about people. I think that my body probably produces a lot of dopamine. I like novelty. That excites me to learn something new. I like novel things. So a new idea, a new place, a new person. If you approach life that way and you get a lot of joy out of doing those things, investing is just kind of a vehicle that gets you there. It's a great career to attach to that, right? Because it just becomes a part of it. You're learning about the world, the different economies, people. It's the perfect career, actually, if you have that mindset, I think. So that is success to me, is building that happy life that can be sustained for the rest of my life. That, I guess, that would be success for me. It's not a destination. It's a journey, and being happy on that journey and continuously learning. What sounds really unhappy to me is to lead a very stagnant life where I'm not challenged. I'm not ever in a growth mindset. I'm not learning new things, meeting new people, challenging my own assumptions about beliefs. That sounds like not fun to me. So I assume you see it the same way.
Yes, I was going to say I can relate to that. I say sometimes, if I had all the money in the world, I would still do what I do. Keep
Absolutely.
On learning, look up companies. And I hope my clients are not listening, but I would do what I do even if I wasn't paid to do it. It's kind of a bonus.
I agree.
I get paid to learn and read and explore and question and investigate and then meet people like the ValueX crowd, like you and I. It's really remarkable that we get to sit down and talk about things that we're passionate about. I see it just as a pursuit in itself that gives value to my life, but it's a bonus that it's part of it is being an investor, and there's some benefit to it because it leads to some ideas that actually make money, but it's not the goal in itself to accumulate wealth. It's kind of a sideshow to a much more interesting show in the middle of it, which is staying curious and learning.
Yeah. Was that your first trip to ValueX?
It was. It's usually tricky for me to come at that time. So I kept running into Guy Spier many times. And then I told him, I'll come this year. And this was actually my first in-person conference since before COVID. So I was
wow.
really doing all Zooms with people that I know, a lot of Zooms, catching up with people, but I wasn't really going to conferences for a while.
But Did you enjoy it?
Oh, I loved it. I thought the format is great, wonderful people. And just, I told Guy that he creates this environment of sharing. And it's pretty special. And it's a gift. And he said he's manifesting it or channeling it. I said, whatever you call it, it's happening. And I'm grateful to be a part of it.
Listen, I'm so grateful he includes me in so many things. It's very generous, and it means a lot to me that he does that. Are you going to go to the Berkshire Hathaway AGM?
No, we have plans, but maybe next year if they're still hosting it. Fingers crossed.
You know what? This is kind of a fun little story. Last year, I'm well known for taking my kids to this event. They don't go every year, but I do take the kids. And that's my attempt to kind of pound some of this into them at a young age. They shop and they hopefully listen a little bit. I don't know. I think they get a lot out of it. But last year I wrote a piece on taking your kids to Omaha and the different things we do. It's a different experience than a lot of my male colleagues that are there without kids have. Like, I take a break and go roller skating and then come back to the meeting. But anyway, I sent it to Warren Buffett last week. And it was, it was last Friday. So last Friday, probably around 4:40 in the afternoon, I was sitting in the office and I sent it to him through his email, right? It's actually his assistant's email. So I sent and then like 30 minutes later, I looked on my phone and I have a note back signed Warren.
Okay.
So, which is really exciting that he took the time to write back about this piece. I think it's great. You need to go to the Berkshire Hathaway AGM.
I've been before, but I'll go again. I know it's a fun experience and it gets bigger and bigger every year, but it's the people that come and the interactions, it's priceless.
Yeah, it's lots of fun. My girls are going again this year. I just asked them in the car this morning. I said, you know, you don't have to, no pressure. I've already booked the room. Do you want to go or not? And they both said, yes, I want to go. Yes, I was actually really surprised that my older one wanted to go, but she does. So we'll be back again in Nebraska.
What an experience. Listen, Lauren, thank you so much for today. I learned a lot. It was a wonderful conversation. Thank you for sharing all those stories. And I hope we'll do it again at some point and revisit some of the ideas we missed today.
Yeah, same. That'd be great. I appreciate it.
Thank you. You were listening to Talking Billions. We talk about big ideas, big inspirations, big topics. We take on the hardest subject of all, money. But our conversations lead us to an even bigger question: what it means to live a rich life beyond money. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment and follow, subscribe, rate, and share with friends and family. We rely on word of mouth to promote the show. One click for you means the world to us. Thank you. Until next time, your host, Bogumil Baranowski. The content of this podcast is for general informational purposes only, and so are the opinions of members of Seacard Associates, a registered investment advisor, and guests of the show. This podcast does not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any specific security or financial instruments or provide investment advice or service. Past performance is not indicative of future results. More information on Seacard Associates is available in its Form ADV disclosure documents available at advisorinfo.sec.gov.